Chapter 11. When Simon awoke on the morning after the election, he felt both exhausted and exhilarated. He lay in bed, trying to imagine how those Labour ministers, who only the previous day had assumed they would be returning to their departments, would be feeling now. Elizabeth stirred, let out a small, sleep-filled sigh. Simon stared down at his wife. In the 7 years of their marriage, she had lost none of her attraction for him, but he still took pleasure in just looking at her sleeping form. Her long, fair hair rested on her shoulders, and her slim, firm figure curved gently beneath the silk nightgown. He started stroking her back and watched her slowly come out of sleep. When she finally awoke, she turned over, and he took her in his arms. "I admire your energy," she said. "If you're still fit after 3 weeks on the trail, I can hardly claim to have a headache." He smiled, delighted to catch a moment of privacy between the seeming lunacy of electioneering and the anticipation of office. No voter was going to interrupt this rare moment of pleasure.
"Mom,"
said a voice, and Simon quickly turned over to see Peter standing at the door in his pajamas.
"I'm hungry."
On the way back to London in the car, Elizabeth asked, "What do you think he'll offer you?"
"Don't anticipate anything," said Simon. "But I would hope, Under Secretary of State for Housing and Local Government."
"But you're still not certain to be offered a post."
"Not at all. One can never know what permutations and pressures a new Prime Minister has to consider."
"Like what?" asked Elizabeth.
"Left and right wings of the party, north and south of the country, countless debts to be cleared with those people who can claim they played a role in getting him into number 10.
Simon yawned. "Are you saying he could leave you out?"
"Oh, yes. But I'll be livid if he does. And I'd certainly want to know who had been given my job and why."
"And what could you do about it?"
"Nothing. There's absolutely nothing one can do, and every backbencher knows it. The Prime Minister's power of patronage is absolute."
"It won't matter if you continue driving on the centre line," she said. "Are you sure you wouldn't like me to take a turn at the wheel?"
Louise let Andrew lie in on the Friday morning. She knew he had been expecting to return to a higher ministerial office and had been shattered by the election result. By the time Andrew woke, it was nearly 11. He sat in silence in his dressing gown, unshaven, and tapped a hard-boiled egg that refused to crack. An unopened Times lay by his side.
"Thank you for all your hard work," he said, once the second cup of coffee had taken effect.
She smiled. An hour later, dressed in sports jacket and grey flannels, he toured the constituency in a loudspeaker van, thanking his supporters for returning him to Westminster. Louise was by his side, often able to jog his memory on names he couldn't recall. After they'd shaken the last hand, they spent a quiet weekend with Sir Duncan in Stirling, who found it extremely hard to remove the smirk from his face. Raymond was astonished by the election result. He couldn't believe that the opinion polls had been so wrong. He didn't confide in Joyce that he had hoped a Labour victory would bring him into office after languishing on the back benches for what seemed an interminable time.
"There's nothing for it," he told her, "but to rebuild a career at the bar. We may be out of office for years."
"But surely that won't be enough to keep you fully occupied."
"I have to be realistic about the future," he said slowly. "Although I don't intend to let Heath drag us into Europe without putting up one hell of a fight."
"Perhaps they'll ask you to shadow someone."
"No, there are always far fewer jobs available in opposition. And in any case, they always give the orators like Fraser the dispatch box, when all you can do is sit and make noises while we wait for another election."
Raymond wondered how he would broach what was really on his mind, and tried to sound casual when he said, "Perhaps it's time we considered having our own home in the constituency."
"That seems an unnecessary expense," said Joyce, "especially as there's nothing wrong with the appearance home, and in any case, wouldn't they be offended?"
"My first interest should be my duty to the constituents, and this would be a chance to prove a long-term commitment to them. Naturally, my parents will understand."
"But we can't afford the cost of two houses," said Joyce uncertainly.
"I realise that, but it's you who've always wanted to live in Leeds, and this will give you the chance to stop commuting from London every week. After I've done the rounds, why don't you stay up? Contact a few local estate agents and see what's on the market."
"All right,
if that's what you really want," said Joyce. "I'll start next week." Charles and Fiona spent a quiet weekend at their cottage in Sussex. Charles tried to do some gardening while he kept one ear open for the telephone. Fiona began to realise how anxious he was when she looked through the French windows and saw her finest delphinium being taken for a weed. Charles eventually gave the weeds a reprieve and came in and turned on the television to catch Maudlin, MacLeod, Thatcher and Carrington enter No. 10 Downing Street, looking pensive, only to leave smiling. The senior appointments had been made. The cabinet was taking shape. The new Prime Minister came out and waved to the crowds before being whisked away in his official car. Would he remember who had organised the young vote for him before he was even the party leader?
"When do you want to go back to Eaton Square?" Fiona inquired from the kitchen.
"Depends," said Charles.
"On what?"
"On whether the phone rings." Simon sat staring at the television. All those hours of work on housing and local government, and the PM had offered the portfolio to someone else. He had left the set on all day, but didn't learn who it was, only that the rest of the housing and local government team had remained intact. "Why do I bother?" he said out loud. "The whole thing's a farce."
"What were you saying, darling?"
asked Elizabeth as she came into the room. The phone rang again. It was the newly appointed Home Secretary, Reginald Maudling.
"Simon? Reggie, many congratulations on your appointment. Not that it came as a great surprise."
"That's what I'm calling about, Simon. Would you like to join me at the Home Office as Under Secretary?"
"Like to? I'd be delighted."
"Thank heavens for that," said Maudling. "It took me a dickens of a time to convince Ted Heath that you should be released from the Housing and Local Government team."
When Andrew and Louise arrived back at Cheyne Walk after the weekend, a red box was waiting for him in the drawing room. Under Secretary of State for Scotland was printed in gold on the side.
"They'll be round to collect that later today," he told Louise. He turned the key to find the box was empty. Then he saw a small envelope in one corner. It was addressed to Andrew Fraser, Esquire, MP. He tore it open. It contained a short handwritten note from the permanent secretary, the senior civil servant at the Scottish office. In keeping with a long tradition, ministers are presented with the last red box from which they worked. "Au revoir. No doubt we will meet again."
"I suppose it could be used as a lunchbox," said Louise, standing by the door.
"Or perhaps an overnight case," offered Andrew.
"Or a very small cot," added his wife, trying to make her words casual. Andrew looked up to see Louise looking radiant.
"I let your parents know last night, but I wasn't going to tell you until dinner this evening."
Andrew threw his arms around her.
"By the way," Louise added, "we've already decided on her name."
When Raymond arrived back at Lincoln's Inn, he let his clerk know that he wanted to be flooded with work. Over lunch with Sir Nigel Hartwell, the head of chambers,
He explained that he thought it unlikely that the Labour Party would be in government again for some considerable time.
The edge is on your side, Raymond. Another full parliament and you'll be barely 40, so you can still look forward to many years in the cabinet.
I wonder, said Raymond, uncharacteristically hesitant.
Well, you needn't worry about briefs. Solicitors have been calling constantly since it was known you were back on a more permanent basis.
Raymond began to relax. Joyce phoned him after lunch with the news that she hadn't found anything suitable, but the estate agent had assured her that they were expecting a lot more on the market in the autumn.
Well, keep looking, said Raymond.
Don't worry, I will, said Joyce, sounding as if she was enjoying the whole exercise. If we find something, perhaps we can think of starting a family, she added tentatively.
Perhaps, said Raymond brusquely.
Charles eventually received a call on the Monday night, not from number 10 Downing Street, but from number 12, the office of the Chief Whip. Because the Chief Whip's is not an official post, he's paid as the Parliamentary Secretary to the Treasury, and he works from number 12. The Prime Minister and Chancellor of the Exchequer, being the First and Second Lords of the Treasury, live at numbers 10 and 11 Downing Street, respectively. The Chief Whip had phoned to say that he hoped that Charles would be willing to soldier on as Junior Whip. When he heard the disappointment in Charles's voice, he added,
For the time being.
For the time being, repeated Charles, and put the phone down. At least you're a member of the government. You haven't been left out in the cold, said Fiona gamely.
True, he replied.
People are sure to come and go during the next 5 years. Charles had to agree with his wife, but it didn't lessen his disappointment. Returning to the Commons as a member of the government, however, turned out to be far more rewarding than he'd expected. This time, it was his party that were making the decisions. The Queen travelled early that July morning to the House of Lords in the Irish state coach. An escort of the household cavalry accompanied her, preceded by a procession of lesser state carriages, in which the imperial state crown and other royal trappings were transported. Charles could remember watching the ceremony from the streets when he was a boy. Now he was taking part in it. When the Queen arrived at the upper house, she was accompanied by the Lord Chancellor through the Sovereign's entrance to the robing room, where her ladies-in-waiting began to prepare her for the ceremony. Charles always considered the state opening of Parliament a special occasion for members of both houses. As a whip, he watched the members take their seats in the Commons and await the arrival of Black Rod. Once the Queen was seated on the throne, the Lord Great Chamberlain commanded the gentleman usher of Black Rod to inform the Commons that it is Her Majesty's pleasure they attend her immediately in this house. Black Rod, wearing his black topcoat, black waistcoat, black knee-breeches, black stockings, and black shoes, resembled the devil's advocate rather than the Queen's messenger. He marched alone across the great tiled floor joining the two chambers until he reached the doors of the House of Commons, which were slammed in his face when he was just 2 paces away from them. He struck the door 3 times with the silver tip of his long, thin black rod. In response, a little window in the door was flicked back to check on who it was. Not unlike a sleazy nightclub, Charles's father had once observed. Black Rod was then allowed admittance to the lower house. He advanced towards the table and made 3 obeisances to the chair before saying, Mr. Speaker, the Queen commands this honourable house to attend Her Majesty immediately in the House of Peers. With that, the sergeant-at-arms, bearing the mace, led Mr. Speaker, in full court dress, a gold-embroidered gown of black satin damask, back towards the Lords. They were followed by the Clerk of the House and the Speaker's chaplain, behind whom came the Prime Minister, accompanied by the Leader of the Opposition. Then government ministers, with their opposite numbers,
and finally as many backbenchers as could squeeze into the rear of the Lord's chamber. The Lords themselves were waiting in the upper house, dressed in red capes with ermine collars, looking somewhat like benevolent Draculas, accompanied by peeresses glittering in diamond tiaras and wearing long evening dresses. The Queen was seated on the throne in her full monarchical robes, the imperial state crown on her head, originally made for George IV. She waited until the procession had filled the chamber, and all was still. The Lord Chancellor shuffled forward, and bending down on one knee, presented her with a printed document. It was the speech written by the government of the day, and although she had read over a copy of the script earlier that morning, she had made no personal contribution to its contents, as her role on this occasion was only ceremonial. She looked up at her subjects and began to read.
This ends side two of cassette three of First Among Equals. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette four. Cassette four.
Charles stood at the back of the cramped gathering, but with his height he had no trouble in following the entire proceedings. Their lordships were all in their places for the Queen's speech, with the law lords seated in their privileged position in the centre of the chamber, an honour bestowed upon them by an act of 1539. The Lord Chancellor stood to one side of the woolsack, which was stuffed with wool from the days when it was the staple commodity of England. When the lords are in session, he acts much as the Speaker does for the Commons. Charles could spot his elderly father, the Earl of Bridgewater, nodding off during the Queen's speech, which promised that Britain would make a determined effort to become a full member of the EEC. "My government also intends to bring in a bill to enact trade union reform," she declared. Charles, along with everyone else from the Commons, was counting the likely number of bills that would be presented during the coming months, and soon worked out that the Whip's office were going to be in for a busy session. As the Queen finished her speech, Charles took one more look at his father, now sound asleep. How Charles dreaded the moment when he would be standing there watching his brother Rupert in ermine. The only compensation would be if he could produce a son who would one day inherit the title, as it was now obvious Rupert would never marry. It was not as if he and Fiona had not tried. He was beginning to wonder if the time had not come to suggest that she visit a specialist. He dreaded finding out that she was unable to bear a child. The speech delivered, the sovereign left the upper house, followed by Prince Philip and Prince Charles, to a fanfare of trumpets. At the other end of the chamber, the procession of MPs, led again by the Speaker, made their way back in pairs from the red benches of the Lords to the green of the Commons. The leader of the Opposition, having formed his own team, invited Andrew to cover the Home Office brief as number two. Andrew was delighted by the challenge of his new responsibility, especially when he discovered Simon Carslake was to be his opposite number in government. Louise once again became very large in a short period, but Andrew tried to keep his mind off the pregnancy, as he dreaded her going through that amount of pain and sorrow for a third time. He telephoned Elizabeth Carslake, and they agreed to meet privately. "That's a hard question to answer without ifs and buts," she told Andrew over coffee in her room the following day. "But what would your advice be if Louise were to lose the third child?" Elizabeth took a long time considering her reply. "If that happened, I can't believe it would be wise to put her through the same ordeal again," she said flatly. "The psychological repercussions alone might affect her for the rest of her life." Andrew sat staring in front of him. "Enough of this morbid talk," Elizabeth added. "I checked Louise last week, and I can see no reason why this shouldn't turn out to be a routine birth." As the first weeks of the new Tory administration took shape, Simon and Andrew became locked in battle over several issues, and were soon known as the Mongoose and the Rattlesnake,
When either of the names Karslake or Fraser were cranked up in the old-fashioned war machines, indicating one of them had risen to speak, members drifted back into the chamber. Andrew found himself a constant visitor to the table office, a tiny room in the corridor behind the speaker's chair, where members tabled their questions, usually scribbled on yellow sheets, but still acceptable to the omniscient clerks, had they been written on postage stamps. The clerks would often help Andrew reword a question so that it would be acceptable to the chair, a function they carried out for any member, even Tom Carson, who had once accused them of political bias when they suggested one of his questions was out of order. When Carson was finally referred to the speaker, he was called for and reprimanded, and his question deposited in one of the mock Gothic wastepaper baskets in the order office. Once behind the speaker's chair, Simon and Andrew would good-humouredly discuss the issues on which they were crossing swords. The opportunity to be out of sight of the press gallery above them was often taken by the two opposing members. But once they had both returned to the dispatch box, they would tear into each other, looking for any weakness in the other's argument. On one subject, they found themselves in total accord. Ever since August 1969, when the troops had first been sent in, Parliament had been having another of its periodic bouts of trouble with Northern Ireland. In October 1970, the House devoted a full day's business to listen to members' opinions in the never-ending effort to find a solution to the growing clash between the Protestant extremists and the IRA. The motion before the House was to allow emergency powers to be renewed in the province. Andrew rose from his seat on the front bench to deliver the opening speech for the opposition. He said he took no side in this unhappy affair, but felt sure the House was united in condemning violence. Yet, however hard he searched for the answer, he found neither faction willing to give an inch. Goodwill and trust were words that might as well have been left out of any dictionary printed in Ulster. It was not long before Andrew came to the conclusion that Gladstone was right when he said, "Every time I find the solution to the Irish question, they change the question." When Andrew had finished, he surprised members by leaving the chamber and not returning for several minutes. Simon had been selected to wind up for the government and had prepared his speech with meticulous care. Although both sides appeared in agreement on the main issue, the mood, as always, could change in a moment if an unfortunate view was expressed by a government minister. During the debate, much to everyone's surprise, Andrew Fraser kept leaving the chamber. Simon left only twice between 3:30 and the 10 o'clock division, once to take a call from his wife, and then again at 7:30 for a quick supper. When Simon came back, Andrew was still absent from the chamber, and he had not returned by the time the Shadow Home Secretary began to sum up. Andrew did eventually take his seat on the front bench, but Simon had already begun his speech. As Andrew entered the chamber and took his place on the front bench, an elderly Conservative rose from his seat.
"On a point of order, Mr. Speaker."
Simon sat down immediately and turned his head to listen to the point his colleague wanted to make.
"Is it not a tradition of this House, sir," began the elder statesman rather ponderously, "for a front bench spokesman to have the courtesy to remain in his seat during the debate in order that he may ascertain views other than his own?"
"That is not a point of order," replied the Speaker above the cries of "Hear, hear" from the Conservative benches.
Andrew scribbled a quick note and hurriedly passed it over to Simon. On it was written a single sentence.
"I accept the point my right honourable friend makes," Simon began, "and would have complained myself had I not known that the honourable gentleman, the member for Edinburgh Carlton, has spent most of the afternoon in hospital."
Simon paused to let the effect sink in.
"Where his wife was in labour. I am not given to accepting as necessarily accurate all the opposition tells me," he continued, "but I am able to confirm this statement because it was my wife who delivered the baby."
The House began to laugh.
"I can assure my honourable friend that my wife has spent her entire afternoon indoctrinating the infant in the value of conservative policies as understood by his grandfather,"
which is why the Honourable Gentleman has found it necessary to absent himself from so much of the debate. Simon waited for the laughter to subside. For those members of the House who thrive on statistics, it is a boy, and he weighs 4 pounds 3 ounces. There are times in the House when affection is displayed on both sides, thought Andrew, who considered it was ironic that during an Irish debate, an Englishman had demonstrated such affection for a Scotsman. There was no challenge when the Speaker collected the voices at 10 o'clock, so the matter was decided on the nod, and Simon joined Andrew behind the Speaker's chair. "Just over 4 pounds doesn't sound very big to me. I thought I'd take a second opinion from the Minister of Health." "I agree," said Andrew. "The little blighter is stuck in an incubator. But your wife is doing everything she can to fatten him up. I'm off to watch him now." "Good luck," said Simon. Andrew sat by the incubator all night, hating the drip, drip, drip of the little plastic tube that passed up the child's nose and down into his stomach. He feared that when he woke, his son would be dead, and continually went to the wash basin and put a damp, cold cloth over his eyes to ensure he remained awake. He finally lost the battle and dozed off in a dad's bed in the corner. When his father woke, Robert Bruce Fraser was very much alive. The crumpled father rose from his bed to admire his crumpled offspring, who was receiving milk down the plastic tube from a night nurse. Andrew stared down at the crinkly face. The boy had inherited his square jaw, but had his mother's nose and hair colouring. Andrew chuckled at the time Louise had wasted over girls' names. Robert, it would be. Robert Bruce Fraser travelled to Cheney Walk with his mother and father 3 weeks later, having topped the scales earlier that morning at 5 pounds 10 ounces. Elizabeth Carslake had told them to be thankful. The postnatal examination had shown that it would not be possible for Louise to bear another child. Chapter 12. The Chief Whip looked round at his colleagues, wondering which of them would volunteer for such a thankless task. A hand went up, and he was pleasantly surprised.
"Thank you, Charles."
Charles had already warned Fiona that he was going to volunteer to be the whip responsible for the issue that had most dominated the last election, Britain's entry into the EEC. Everyone in that room realised that it would be the most demanding marathon of the entire Parliament, and there was an audible sigh of relief when Charles volunteered.
"Not a job for anyone with a rocky marriage," he heard one whip whisper.
"At least that's something I don't have to worry about," thought Charles, but he made a note to take home some flowers that night. "Why was it the bill everyone wanted to avoid?" asked Fiona as she arranged the daffodils.
"Because many of our side don't necessarily back Edward Heath and his lifelong ambition to take Britain into Europe, while quite a few of the opposition do," said Charles, accepting a large brandy.
"Added to that, we have the problem of presenting a bill to curb the trade unions at the same time, which may well influence many members of the Labour Party from voting with us on Europe. Because of this problem, the Prime Minister requires a regular state of play assessment on Europe, even though legislation may not be presented on the floor of the Commons for at least another year. He'll want to know periodically how many of our side are still against entry, and how many from the opposition we can rely on to break ranks when the crucial vote is taken. Perhaps I should become Member of Parliament, then at least I could spend a little more time with you. Especially on the European issue, if you were a don't know." The great debate was discussed by the media to the point of boredom. Members were nevertheless conscious that they were playing a part in history, and because of the unusual spectacle of the whips not being in absolute control of the voting procedure, the Commons sprang to life, and excitement began to build up over the weeks and months of debate. Charles retained his normal task of watching over 50 members on all normal government bills, but because of the priority given to the issue of entry into Europe, he'd been released from all other duties. He knew that this was his chance to atone for his disastrous winding-up speech on the economy, which he sensed his colleagues had still not completely forgotten. "I'm gambling everything on this one," he told Fiona, "and if we lose the final vote, I'll be sentenced to the bank benches for life."
"And if we win?"
"It'll be hard to keep me off the front bench," replied Charles. Robert Fraser was one of those noisy children who, after only a few weeks, sounded as if he was on the front bench.
"Perhaps he's going to be a politician after all," concluded Louise, staring down at her son.
"What has changed your mind?" asked Andrew.
"He never stops shouting at everyone. He's totally preoccupied with himself, and he falls asleep as soon as someone else offers an opinion," she replied.
"At last I think I've found it." After Raymond heard the news, he took the train up to Leeds the following Friday. Joyce had selected four houses for him to consider, but he had to agree with her that the one in Chapel Allerton was exactly what they were looking for. It was also by far the most expensive.
"Can we afford it?" asked Joyce anxiously.
"Probably not, but one of the problems of seeing four houses is that you end up only wanting the best one."
"I could go on looking."
"No, you've found the right house. Now I'll have to work out how we can pay for it. And I think I may have come up with an idea."
Joyce said nothing, waiting for him to continue.
"We could sell our place in Lansdowne Road."
"But where will we live when you're in London?"
"I could rent a small flat somewhere between the Law Courts and the Commons, while you set up our real home in Leeds."
"But wouldn't you get lonely?"
"Of course I will," said Raymond, trying to sound convincing. "But almost every member north of Birmingham is parted from his wife during the week. In any case, you've always wanted to settle in Yorkshire, and this might be our best chance. If my practice continues to grow, we can buy a second house in London at a later date."
Joyce looked apprehensive.
"One added bonus," said Raymond. "Your being in Leeds will ensure I never lose the seat."
She smiled, as she always felt reassured whenever Raymond showed the slightest sign of needing her. On Monday morning, Raymond put in a bid for the house in Chapel Allerton before returning to London. After a little bargaining over the phone during the week, he and the owner settled on a price. By Thursday, Raymond had put his Lansdowne Road house on the market and was surprised by the amount the estate agent thought it would fetch. All Raymond had to do now was find himself a flat. Simon sent a note to Ronnie expressing his thanks for keeping him so well informed about what was happening at Nethercott & Company. It had been 8 months since he had resigned from the board because of his appointment as a minister, but Ronnie saw that the minutes of each meeting were posted to him to study in his own time. His own time. Simon had to laugh at the thought. His overdraft at the bank now stood at a little over £72,000, but as Ronnie intended the shares should be offered at £5 each when they went public, Simon felt sure there was still a fair leeway, as his personal holding should realise £300,000. Elizabeth warned him not to spend a penny of the profit until the money was safely in the bank. He was thankful she didn't know the full extent of his borrowing. Over one of their occasional lunches at the Ritz, Ronnie spelled out to Simon his plans for the future of the company.
"Now that the Tories are in, I think I'll go public in 18 months' time. This year's profits are up again, and next year's look even better. So 1973 looks a perfect bet."
Simon looked apprehensive, and Ronnie responded quickly.
"If you're having any problems, Simon, I'll be happy to take the shares off your hands at their market value. At least that way you show a small profit."
"No, no," said Simon. "I'll hang in there now that I've waited this long."
"Suit yourself," said Ronnie. "Now, tell me, are you enjoying the Home Office?"
Simon put down his knife and fork.
"Of the three great offices of state, it's the one most involved with people,
so there's a new challenge at a personal level every day, although it can be depressing too. Locking people up in prisons, banning immigrants and deporting harmless aliens isn't my idea of fun. The Home Office never seems to want anyone to enjoy too much freedom. What about Ireland?
What about Ireland? Said Simon, shrugging his shoulders.
I give the North back to ERA, said Ronnie. We'll let them go independent and give them a large cash incentive to do so. At the moment, the whole exercise is money down the drain.
We're discussing people, said Simon, not money.
90% of the voters would back me, said Ronnie, lighting a cigar.
Everyone imagines 90% of the people support their views until they stand for election, said Simon. The issue of Ireland is far too important to be glib about. I repeat, we're discussing people, 8 million people, all of whom have the same right to justice as you and I. And as long as I work in the Home Office, I intend to see that they get it.
Ronnie remained silent.
No, I'm sorry, Ronnie, continued Simon. Too many people have an easy solution to Ireland. If there was an easy solution, the problem wouldn't have lasted over 200 years.
Don't be sorry, said Ronnie. I'm so stupid, I've only just worked out for the first time why you're in public office.
You're a typical self-made fascist, said Simon, teasing his companion once again.
You may be right, but you won't change my mind on hanging. Your lot should bring back the rope. The streets aren't safe any longer.
For property developers like you, hoping for a quick killing? Both men laughed.
Andrew, do you want lunch?
In a moment.
That's what you said half an hour ago.
I know, but he's nearly got it. Just give me a few more minutes.
Louise waited and watched, but Robert collapsed in a heap again.
No doubt you're expecting him to play soccer for England by the time he's two.
Oh, certainly not, said Andrew, carrying his son back into the house. Rugby for Scotland.
Louise was touched by the amount of time Andrew spent with Robert. She told her disbelieving friends that he regularly fed and bathed the baby, and even changed his nappy.
Don't you think he's good-looking?
Asked Andrew, strapping his son carefully into his chair.
Yes, said Louise, laughing.
That's because he looks like me, said Andrew, putting his arms round his wife.
He most certainly does not, said Louise firmly.
Crash! A bowl full of porridge had been deposited on the floor, leaving just a lump left in the spoon, which Robert was now smearing across his face and hair.
He looks as if he's just stepped out of a concrete mixer, said Andrew.
Louise stared at her son.
Perhaps you're right. There are times when he looks like you.
How do you feel about rape? Asked Raymond.
I can't see that it's relevant, Stephanie Arnold replied.
I think they'll go for me on it, said Raymond.
But why?
They'll be able to pin me in a corner, damage my character.
But where does it get them? They can't prove lack of consent.
Maybe, but they'll offer it as background to prove the rest of the case.
Because you raped someone doesn't prove you murdered them. Raymond and Stephanie Arnold, who was new to Chambers, continued discussing their first case together on their way to the Old Bailey, and she left Raymond in no doubt that she was delighted to be led by him. They were to appear together to defend a labourer accused of the rape and murder of his stepdaughter.
Open and shut case, unfortunately, said Raymond. But we're going to make the Crown prove their argument beyond anyone's doubt.
When the case stretched into a second week, Raymond began to believe that the jury were so gullible they might even get their client off. Stephanie was sure they would. The day before the judge's summing up, Raymond invited Stephanie to dinner at the House of Commons. That'll make them turn their heads, he thought to himself. They won't have seen anything in a white shirt and black stockings that looks like that for some time. Certainly not Mr. Speaker. Stephanie seemed flattered by the invitation and sat through the stodgy meal served in the stranger's dining room, obviously impressed as former cabinet ministers flitted in and out, all of them acknowledging him. "How's the new flat?" asked Stephanie.
"Worked out well," replied Raymond. "The Barbican is so convenient for Parliament and the law courts."
"Does your wife like it?" she asked, lighting a cigarette, but not looking at him directly.
"She is not in town that much nowadays. She spends most of her time in Leeds. Doesn't care much for London."
The awkward pause that followed was interrupted by a sudden clanging of bells.
"Are we on fire?" asked Stephanie, quickly stubbing out her cigarette. "No,"
said Raymond, laughing. "Just the 10 o'clock division. I have to leave you and vote. I'll be back in about 15 minutes.
Shall I order coffee?"
"No, don't bother," said Raymond. "It's foul. Perhaps you'd like to come back to the Barbican, and then you can give a verdict on my flat."
"Maybe it's an open and shut case," she smiled.
Raymond returned the smile before joining his colleagues as they flooded out of the dining room down the corridor towards the Commons Chamber. He didn't have time to explain to Stephanie that he had only 6 minutes to get into the right lobby. As Raymond had no idea what they were voting on that night, he followed the surge of Labour members into the No's lobby. The bells stopped, and the doors were bolted. Whenever the vote is called for at the end of the debate, the Speaker puts the question, and the moment he reaches the words, "I think the ayes have it," the roar of "No" from those opposed to the motion ensures a vote at 10 o'clock. Bells peal out over the Palace of Westminster, and in some nearby restaurants and members' homes in the division bell area. Members then scurry into the ayes or noes division lobby before the cry of "lock the doors" is heard. Once the doors have been secured, each member then files past two clerks seated at a high desk at the far end of the corridor, who tick off his name. As Raymond stepped past the clerks, he came toward the exit doors, which were angled so as to make a funnel through which only one member at a time could pass. The whip, acting as teller, shouted out the mounting vote.
73, he called as Raymond passed him.
The only particular rule relating to voting was that members could not wear a hat or overcoat while in the lobby. A clerk had once told Raymond that this dated from the days when lazy members sent their driver off in the hansom cab, hat over ears, coat buttoned up to his nose, to march through the corridors and give their masters' names. Some of them would have been a damn sight better MPs than their employers, Raymond had often thought. While in the corridor, he discovered that they were voting on a clause of the trade union bill concerning the validity of closed shops. He was in no doubt that he supported his party on that subject. When he returned to the stranger's dining room after the vote, he found Stephanie checking her face in a compact mirror, a small, round face with green eyes and brunette hair. She was replacing the trace of lipstick. He suddenly felt conscious of being a little overweight for a man not yet 40. "Shall we go?" he suggested, after he'd signed the bill. Once they had reached the flat, Raymond put on a Charles Aznavour record and retired to the small kitchen to prepare coffee. He was totally oblivious to the fact that women were beginning to find him attractive. A little extra weight and a few grey hairs had not harmed his appearance, if anything, giving him an air of authority. "There's no doubting this is a bachelor flat," Stephanie remarked as she took in one comfortable leather chair, the pipe stand and the spy cartoons of turn-of-the-century judges and politicians.
"I suppose that's because that's what it is," he mused, setting down a tray laden with coffee and two brandy balloons, generously filled with cognac.
"Don't you get lonely?" she asked.
"From time to time," he said, pouring the coffee.
"And between times?"
"Black?" he asked, not looking at her.
"Black," she said.
"Sugar?"
For a man who served as a Minister of the Crown, and who, it's rumoured, is about to become the youngest QC in the country, you're still very unsure of yourself with women.
Raymond blushed.
but raised his head and stared into her eyes. In the silence, he caught Aznavour's words, "You've let yourself go." "Would my honourable friend care to dance?" she said quietly. Raymond could still remember the last occasion he had danced. This time, he was determined it would be different. He held Stephanie so that their bodies touched, and they swayed rather than danced to the music of Marcel Stelman. She didn't notice Raymond slipping off his glasses and putting them into his jacket pocket. He bent over and kissed her neck. She gave a long sigh, and when they parted, she said, "Let's hope this is between times." Charles studied his chart of 330 conservatives. He felt confident of 217, not sure about 54, and had almost given up on 59. On the Labour side, the best information he could glean was that 50 socialists were expected to defy the whip and join the government's ranks when the great vote took place. "The main fly in the ointment," Charles reported to the chief whip, "is still the trade union reform bill. The left are trying to convince those socialists who still support the bill that there's no cause so important for which they should enter the same lobby as those Tory trade union bashers." He went on to explain his fear that unless the government were willing to modify the trade union bill, they might lose Europe on the back of it. "Alec Pimpkin doesn't help matters by trying to gather the waverers in our party around him. There's no chance of the Prime Minister modifying one sentence of the trade union bill," said the chief whip, draining his gin and tonic. "He promised it in his speech at the party conference, and he intends to deliver by the time he goes to Blackpool at the end of this year. I can also tell you he isn't going to like your conclusions on Pimpkin, Charles. He cares almost as passionately about trade union reform as he does about Europe." Charles was about to protest. "I'm not complaining. You've done damn well so far. Just keep working on the 50 waverers. Threaten, cajole, bully, bribe, try anything. But get them in the right lobby come the night. Pimpkin included." "How about sex?" asked Charles. "You've been seeing too many American films," said the chief whip, laughing. "In any case, I don't think we've got anyone other than Miss Norse to offer them." Charles returned to his office and went over the list once again. His forefinger stopped at the letter P. Charles strolled out into the corridor and looked around. His quarry wasn't there. He checked the chamber. No sign of him. He passed the library. No need to look in there, he thought, and moved on to the smoking room, where he found his man about to order another gin. "Alec," said Charles expansively. The rotund figure of Pimpkin looked round. "May as well try bribery first," thought Charles. "Let me get you a drink." "That's good of you, old fellow," said Pimpkin, nervously fingering his bow tie. "Now, Alec, what's this about your voting against the European bill?" Simon was horrified when he read the initial document. Its implications were all too evident. The report of the new Boundary Commission had been left in the red box for him to study over the weekend. He had agreed at a meeting of Home Office officials that he would steer it through the House as quickly as possible, so that it would make the basis for the seats to be contested at the next election. As the Secretary of State reminded him, there must be no hold-ups. Simon had read the document carefully. In essence, the changes made sense, and because of the movement of families from urban to rural areas, it would undoubtedly create more winnable seats for the Conservatives overall. No wonder the party wanted no hold-ups. But what could he do about the decision the Commission had come to on his own constituency, Coventry Central? His hands were tied. If he suggested any change from the Boundary Commission's recommendations, he would rightly be accused of gerrymandering. Because of the city's dwindling population, the Commission had recommended that the four constituencies of Coventry become three. Coventry Central was to be the one to disappear. its voters distributed among Coventry West, Coventry East, and Coventry North. Simon realized this would leave one safe seat for his sitting colleague and two safe Labour seats. It had never been far from his mind how marginal a constituency he represented. Now he was on the verge of being without one at all. He would have to traipse around the country all over again, looking for a new seat to fight at the next election, while at the same time taking care of his constituents in the moribund one, and at the stroke of a pen, his pen, they would pass on their loyalties to someone else. If only he had remained in housing and local government, he could have put up a case for keeping all four seats. Elizabeth was sympathetic when he explained the problem, but told him not to concern himself too much until he'd spoken to the vice-chairman of the party, who advised candidates which constituencies were likely to become available. "It may even work out to your advantage," she added.
"What do you mean?" said Simon.
"You could get a safer seat nearer London. With my luck, I'll end up with a marginal in Newcastle." Elizabeth prepared his favourite meal and spent the evening trying to keep up his spirits. After three portions of shepherd's pie, Simon fell asleep almost as soon as he'd put his head on the pillow. But she stayed awake long into the night. The casual conversation with the head of gynaecology at St. Mary's kept running through her mind. Although she hadn't confided in Simon, she could recall her supervisor's every word. "I notice from the roster that you've had far more days off than you're entitled to, Dr. Carslake. You must make up your mind if you want to be a doctor or the wife of an MP." Elizabeth stirred restlessly as she considered the problem, but came to no conclusion, except not to bother Simon while he had so much on his mind. "Do these boundary changes affect you?" Louise asked, looking up from her copy of the Times. Andrew was bouncing a small rubber ball on Robert's head.
"You'll give him brain damage," said Louise.
"I know, but think of the goals he'll score, and it won't be long before I can start him on rugby." Robert started to cry when his father stopped to answer his mother's question. "No, Edinburgh isn't affected. There's such a small movement in the population, the seven city seats will remain intact. The only real changes in Scotland will be in Glasgow and the Highlands."
"That's a relief," said Louise.
"I should hate to have to look for another constituency."
"Poor old Simon Carslake is losing his seat altogether, and he didn't do anything about it."
"Why not?" asked Louise.
"Because he's the minister in charge of the bill, and if he tried anything clever, we would crucify him."
"So what will he do?"
"Have to shop around for a new seat, or convince an older colleague to stand down in his favour."
"But surely ministers find it easy to pick up a plum seat."
"Not necessarily," said Andrew. "Many constituencies don't like to have someone foisted on them and want to choose their own man. And some actually prefer a local man who will never be a minister because they feel he can devote more time to them."
"Andrew, can you revert to being some use in opposition?"
"What are you suggesting?" asked Andrew.
"Just keep throwing that ball at your stupid son's head, or he'll be crying all day."
"Take no notice of her, Robert. She'll feel differently when you score your first goal against England."
Chapter 13. At exactly the time Raymond was ready to stop the affair, Stephanie began leaving a set of court clothes in the flat. Although the two had gone their separate ways at the conclusion of the case, they continued to see one another a couple of evenings a week. Raymond had had a spare key made so that Stephanie didn't have to spend her life checking when he had a three-line whip. At first, he began simply to avoid her, but she would then seek him out. When he did manage to give her the slip, he would often find her back in his flat when he returned from the Commons. When he suggested that they should be a little more discreet, she began to make threats, subtle at first, but after a time more direct. During the period of their affair, Raymond conducted three major cases for the Crown, all of which had successful conclusions and which added to his reputation. On each occasion, his clerk made certain Stephanie was not assigned to be with him. Now that his residency problem had been sorted out, Raymond's only worry was how to end their relationship. He quickly discovered that getting rid of Stephanie Arnold was going to prove considerably more difficult than picking her up. Simon was on time for his appointment at Central Office. He explained his dilemma to Sir Edward Mountjoy, vice-chairman of the party responsible for candidates, in graphic detail.
"Well, bloody bad luck," said Sir Edward. "But perhaps I may be able to help," he added,
opening the green folder on the desk in front of him. Simon could see that he was studying a list of names. It made him feel once again like an undergraduate who needed someone to die.
"There seem to be about a dozen safe seats that will fall vacant at the next election, caused either by retirement or redistribution.
Anywhere in particular you could recommend?"
"I fancy Littlehampton."
"Where's that?" said Simon.
"It'll be a new seat, safe as houses. It's in Sussex, on the borders of Hampshire."
He studied an attached map.
"Runs proud to Charles Seymour's constituency, which remains unchanged."
"Can't think you would have many rivals there," said Sir Edward.
"But why don't you have a word with Charles? He's bound to know everyone involved in taking the decision."
"Anything else that looks promising?" asked Simon, only too aware that Seymour might not prove altogether cooperative.
"Let's see. Can't afford to put all your eggs in one basket, can we? Ah, yes, Redcorn in Northumberland."
Again the vice-chairman studied the map.
320 miles from London, and no airport within 80 miles, and their nearest mainline station is 40 miles. I think that one's only worth trying for, if you get desperate. My advice would be to speak to Charles Seymour about Littlehampton. He must know the lay of the land in that neck of the woods."
Two clichés in one sentence, thought Simon. Thank heaven Sir Edward would never have to make a speech from the dispatch box. "I'm sure you're right, Sir Edward," he said.
"Selection committees are being formed already," continued Sir Edward, "so you shouldn't have to wait too long."
"I appreciate your help," said Simon. "Perhaps you could let me know if anything else comes up in the meantime."
"Of course, delighted. The problem is that if one of our side were to die during the sessions, you couldn't desert your present seat because that would cause two by-elections. We certainly don't want a by-election in Coventry Central with you being accused of being a carpetbagger somewhere else."
"Don't remind me," said Simon. Charles had whittled down the 59 anti-Common Market members to 51, but he was now dealing with the hard colonel who seemed quite immune to future advancement or bullying. When he made his next report to the chief whip, Charles assured him that the Conservatives, who would vote against entry into Europe, were outnumbered by the Socialists, who had declared that they would support the government. The chief whip seemed pleased, but asked if Charles had made any progress with Pimkin's disciples.
"Those 12 mad right-wingers," said Charles sharply. "They seem to be willing to follow Pimkin even into the valley of death. I've tried everything, but they're still determined to vote against Europe, whatever the cost."
"The maddening thing is that that bloody nuisance Pimkin has nothing to lose," said the chief whip. "His seat disappears at the end of this parliament in the redistribution. I can't imagine anyone with his extreme views would find a constituency to select him. But by then he'll have done the damage."
The chief whip paused.
"If his 12 would even abstain, I'd feel confident of advising the PM of victory."
"The problem is to find a way of turning Pimkin into Judas and then urging him to lead the chosen 12 into our camp," said Charles.
"You achieve that, and we'd certainly win."
Charles returned to the whip's office to find Simon Carslake waiting by his desk. "I dropped by on the off chance, hoping you might be able to spare me a few moments," said Simon.
"Of course," said Charles, trying to sound welcoming. "Take a pew."
Simon sat down opposite him. "You may have heard that I lose my constituency as a result of the Boundary Commission report, and Edward Mountjoy suggested I have a word with you about Littlehampton, the new seat that borders your constituency."
"It does indeed.
said Charles, masking his surprise. He had not considered the problem as his own.